Switzerland, IBM and the Holocaust.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
People who will not use their intelligence are no better than animals who do not have intelligence. Such people are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent. And yes, Mr. Couch Potato, I am talking to you.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Fallujah, Iraq. Remember the city devastated by coalition weapons when Iraq was invaded? Well, the Iraqi resistance are back. The West and our oil companies certainly don't seem to control the hearts and minds of the Iraqis anymore. Plus, Chancellor George Osborne is going to set out his stall this week. Well, he has done, and we're going to hear from him. What does Martin Summers make of his economic speech? Plus, World Wars 1 and 2. Seamus Milne in The Guardian is writing about World War 1, what it really means, the anniversary this year. And also, World War 2, IBM and the Holocaust. We get to the root of the worries over mass data collection, something the Nazis were obsessed with, and how the Americans, during the war, via Switzerland, made a lot of money from helping the Nazis out. But we start this week in Fallujah, Martin. Big problems for the Iraqi government, it seems, Western-backed as it is at the moment, generally. What do you think's going on there? We had a big problems, didn't we, 2002-2004 over in Fallujah, with really quite nasty, massive, long battles and actually allegations of use of chemical weapons by the coalition forces.
Yeah, well, obviously it's easy. All the information I have on this is what I read. I'm not in Iraq, and we're not in direct contact with people. The fact is that the war in Syria is spilling over into Iraq, and the rebel front, which has taken control of Fallujah, and the Maliki government, which is the elected government. There's an election coming up in April in Iraq. The Maliki government is partly supported by the Americans, but also partly supported by the Iranians. The Maliki government supports the Assad regime in Syria. So the rebels in Fallujah are aligned with the rebels in Syria, and in actual fact, often the same people, because in actual fact, Iraq and Syria aren't two separate countries. They're one great big area in which families actually straddle the border.
OK, latest report a couple of hours ago from Al Jazeera is that roughly 14,000 Iraqis have had to seek refuge in the country's northern Kurdish region after escaping violence in Anbar Project... province. Refugees came from Fallujah, where the humanitarian situation is rapidly deteriorating. People who were trapped in the city did not have access to food or fuel for many days. Pro-government fighters and Iraqi security forces have recently been involved in an operation against Al-Qaeda-linked fighters of the Islamic State in Iraq and Levant, ISIL. Now, it does seem, doesn't it, that the people that we've been aiding to fight in Syria may have decided, well, they're not that interested in Assad anymore. They would rather take over parts of Iraq. I mean, is it possible that these are the same people?
Well, they are the same people. The contradiction in Western policy is glaring. So the Maliki government, which is actually has got a fairly poor human rights record. I mean, the Americans were training them in torture techniques. The Guardian uncovered that. General McChrystal was out there showing them how to disappear people and torture them like they used to do in Latin America. So the Maliki government, which is a Shiite-backed government, is actually quite close to the Iranians and quite close to Assad. But being the elected government, and they possibly will win again in April, being as the Shias are in the majority in Iraq, they are fighting these Al-Qaeda-based groups, or what the West calls Al-Qaeda groups, in Fallujah. But those very same groups are the groups fighting to overthrow Assad. And they're the good guys when they're trying to overthrow Assad, and the bad guys when they're trying to fight Maliki. And we can't quite work out what's going on here. What I will say is this is a mess. And Tony Blair and the people who set that war up need to be prosecuted.
No, the people who are supplying weapons to the rebels in Syria also need to take a good, long, hard look at what they've been up to.
Indeed.
Because we've now seen also, a few days ago, this is Doctors Without Borders staffers being seized in Syria. And five staffers of the international aid organisation Doctors Without Borders taken for questioning in northern Syria. Five staffers were taken allegedly for questioning from a Doctors Without Borders house in northern Syria and been out of contact since the middle of last week, said one of the spokespeople for the aid group. Now, it starts to look as if rather than actually attacking and getting on with their war, supposedly, these rebels in Syria, they're looking for other people and easier targets. And this is in northern Syria. So what's happening is that the government in Syria is actually taking back control of the country, various places where the rebels have been taking hold, and they're pushing these rebels out to the margins of Syria.
Well, they are, but of course, in Iraq, Anbar province is next to Syria, and this is where the Sunni Anbar province has got a Sunni majority. They were having protests during the Arab Spring, and they were briefly put down by the Iraqi security forces, killing scores of people, and the Islamic army of Iraq and what is it, Islamic army of Iraq and the Levant. They are capitalising on the discontent within the Sunni community. I understand that the Sunni tribal leaders are in the middle. They don't support Maliki or Al-Qaeda, of course they will be changing sides because it's all becoming incredibly complicated, like most of these wars
are. Canadian Broadcasting is talking about a wave of kidnappings in Syria. Opposition-held areas of northern and eastern Syria have seen a wave of kidnappings over the past 6 months. Yeah. It has targeted journalists, aid workers and activists. Al-Qaeda-linked rebel factions are suspected of being behind many of these abductions. In October, several members of the International Committee of the Red Cross were abducted in northwestern Syria. Many Syrian activists have fled the country after threats by ISIL, this is this same group, and the killing of a number of citizen journalists. So ISIL seems to be another factor, doesn't it, along with these Al-Qaeda rebels. What's the difference between these two factions?
Well, ISIL is what the West is calling the Al-Qaeda rebels. And they're actually the front up operates both in Iraq and in Syria. What you've got is the Saudis are supplying a lot of weaponry to these people. And let me remind listeners, regular listeners, that the French Foreign Minister, Roland Dumas, was on French television at the end of last year saying that he was approached before the Arab Spring by British officials at an international meeting where they said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Now, I would have a question to David Cameron about that. Is the former French Foreign Minister lying? Is he making it up? Or was it indeed the case that British officials, I presume MI6 or similar, were planning an armed uprising in Syria? Because if they were, then they are responsible for this mess. And so when the British say, oh, what can we do? Shall we bomb Assad because he's using chemical weapons, although it's not clear that he did? What can we do about this terrible situation? Well, the first thing you can do is not start the war in the first place.
But if they weren't responsible, then they're not responsible.
Well, maybe not. Well, if David Cameron...
Getting back to Fallujah for a minute, this is really the second big battle in Fallujah. The first one took place during the invasion of Iraq. It's just... I think about 50-100 kilometres west of Baghdad, and really it seems that there is this kind of group of Arab fighters who are now armed to the teeth, largely thanks to people like Saudi Arabia and Britain actually helping them and the United States, and they have their own agenda. They want to form this Islamic caliphate. Do you think they're going to get it? Because they seem to be gathering support.
No. Don't forget that Al-Qaeda was originally set up by the Western intelligence services, and they perform a dual function, and we can see that dual function represented very clearly in this case. On the one level, they retreated. Oh, the Al-Qaeda have taken over Fallujah. Isn't this terrible? These terrible Al-Qaeda people, we've got to do something about it. We'll quickly rush some Hellfire missiles to the Maliki government to help them out to destroy these terrible Al-Qaeda rebels. And then in Syria, they are freedom fighters trying to get rid of the evil Assad regime, but these are exactly the same people, and we can see how the West uses Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda groups are actually completely infiltrated by Western intelligence services and the Saudis, for example. The Saudi intelligence services direct a lot of their activities, and of course these groups are also related to the groups that bomb Volgograd, which we were talking about the other week. So the Russians are being drawn in. Can't people see what goes on here? These groups are encouraged to make mayhem, and then the West says, oh, there's mayhem over here. here, we'll have to intervene. And that's what's happening in Africa, it's happening in South Sudan, it's happening all over the world, and ultimately this is going to end in catastrophe for everybody. But I think anybody in Britain who thought invading Iraq was a good idea needs their head examined. And the fact is that those who thought it was a good idea have only themselves to blame as we go over the waterfall here.
Now, I mentioned Seamus Milne too. He's looking back at the First World War, and there are a lot of people, there's been a lot of contention, hasn't there, between largely between the Education Secretary Michael Gove and the rest of the world. Michael Gove saying actually that the people that died in the First World War didn't die in vain, that it was a noble cause to really push back the Kaiser and Germany, which was very important at the time. Seamus Milne's taken issue, as well as many others have, in saying that in The Guardian this week, that the First World War was an imperial bloodbath. It's a warning, not a local cause. I suppose by saying it is a warning, he's saying, well, we should look back and make sure this kind of thing never happens again. He says Tory claims that 1914 was a fight for freedom are absurd. But then history wars are about the future as much about the past.
Well, I think as a lover of history, I would suggest that when you're looking at an event like the First World War, you've got to look at all the complexity of it and see it in its context. And that doesn't mean that we should be flag-waving about it, nor does it mean that those who fought in it were completely tricked or lied to. The fact is that everybody has got a different view on it. And that, for example, in Northern Ireland, nobody on the nationalist side is going to be celebrating 1914 because they rebelled against Britain in 1916 and set up their own state to avoid being part of the whole First World War. Now, in other words, that just shows how contentious this can be. Now, in any case, the British Legion and the Remembrance Day ceremony were set up to remember the dead in a non-partisan fashion. So even those who were opposed to the war could remember the dead. And that's and we ought to, all of us, reflect upon what happened in 1914, because frankly, the situation in 2014 is as bad or worse in the world out there, and the dangers are just as prominent. And don't forget that the states of Iraq and Syria that we were just talking about a minute ago were set up by the British and the French at the end of the First World War without any consultation with the local people whatsoever, even though the British had promised the Hashemite royal family that there was going to be an Arab state outside of the Ottoman Empire. As soon as the war was over, the British and the French carved the place up under the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which created all of the borders and created the potential for the State of Israel. All of the fighting that's going on today, this week, in the Middle East, stems from British and French duplicity at the end of the First World War. So if we're going to talk about the First World War, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the fact that at the end of the war, the British and the French carved up the Middle East and created all of the conflicts that we've got here today. Great achievement. So in other words, the main result of the First World War was the Second World War, and of course if the Middle East explodes, the main result, the final result of the First World War will be the Third World War. And if we don't learn, we never will.
Seamus Milne says they were never going to be able to contain themselves. For all the promises of a dignified commemoration, the Tory right's standard bearers held back for less than 48 hours into the new year before launching a full-throated defence of the war to end all wars. The killing fields of Gallipoli and the Somme have been drenched in blood for a noble cause, declared Michael Gove. Noble cause.
Well, I think what's interesting, there was a very interesting BBC Two documentary about this some while ago in the Time Shift series. The main source of the belief that the First World War had been a terrible waste of human life and a pointless exercise was Lloyd George, who was actually the Prime Minister that won the war for Britain, and he won the election in 1918 far more handsomely than Churchill did in 1945. He was regarded by on all sides as the man who had won the war for Britain, but in actual fact, Lloyd George's opinion was that the war had been a total waste of time, and he was actually very much of that view. So it came right from the top. It was Alan Clark, the right-wing Tory historian, who wrote the book Donkeys about the British military leadership in the war. So the Tories here really are whistling in the dark. You cannot glorify war, any war, and I think many of the people who died and fought in the First World War would actually agree with that, even if it was a just war, and that is absolutely
well, the last
open
survivor.
You should not be using it in this way. That is an insult to the dead.
The last survivor that died last year, Harry Pack, match, he was totally dead against it, wasn't it?
Yep, that's right.
He was one of the people that pointed out that it wasn't a just war at all. That Michael Gove said the slaughter unleashed in 1914 had been a just war for freedom. Hostility to the war, the education secretary has been complaining, had been fostered by left-wingers and comedians who denigrated patriotism and painted the conflict as a misbegotten shambles. Gove was backed by the Prime Minister as talk of international reconciliation was left to junior ministerial ranks. But Boris Johnson went further. The war was the fault of German expansion of aggression, London's mayor pronounced, and called for Labour's shadow education secretary, Tristram Hunt, to be sacked forthwith if he doubted it.
That's absolutely absurd and ridiculous. How are we supposed to get on with the Germans taking that sort of attitude? In Germany, they're taught that the war was started by the Russians. And if you can remember, Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated by a Serbian terrorist in Sarajevo, which sparked the war off. And the Russians mobilised, so the Austro-Hungarians mobilised, so the Germans mobilised, so the British mobilised, the French mobilised, so the British mobilised. In actual fact, we were supporting Tsarist Russia, the biggest and most repressive regime in the world at that time, and that was our ally. So we were fighting to keep the Tsar on his throne, and the German working class were told that they were under threat from being invaded by the Russians, and the Russians did try to invade Germany from the east. The Germans thrashed them. But if you were a German, would you have gone to fight the Tsar? Maybe you would. Now, in other words, it's all more complicated than people think. And of course, Ireland won its freedom in this period by fighting against Britain. And most people in Ireland are actually, that would be their view of where they stand on all of this.
The three great powers involved, the British Empire, the Russians and the Germans, bizarrely had three kings at the time, I suppose you'd call them, a Tsar, the Russian one, who were all cousins. Tsar Nicholas II of Russia, King George V of Britain and Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany were all cousins. So it does start to look, if you look back, as some sort of family squabble that just got out of hand. The fact of the matter was 15 million or so people were killed in the First World War and about 20 million injured just for a family squabble.
Well, yes, it's not a family squabble. What's really going on here is that there was the competition. It was hegemonic competition between capitalist powers, between Britain and Germany in particular. Germany wanted to actually felt that Britain's got all these colonies. They've got a navy, and the Germans are coming late to the game. Feel that they're not getting their fair share of the loot. So they start making noises about they want more of the loot. The British won't give them more of the loot. There's various face-offs in Africa and so on, and eventually they go to war to divide the loot amongst themselves. And of course, by the end of the war, what happens is our ally, Russia, falls down in a revolution where people just say, we're not fighting this war anymore. There was a revolution in Germany at the end of the war, which was cheered on by the Western powers because they wanted to see the Germany out of the war. And there was even rebellions in the French and British armies. The British army rebelled at Etaples. Now, in actual fact, what came out of the First World War was the end of a previous setup in which feudal monarchs used to rule the roost. I mean, all of the empires were brought down in the by the war, and the complexity of the First World War defies simplistic analysis. All war is in fact chaotic. Who are the good guys today in Fallujah? I don't know. Who are the good guys in the trenches in the First World War? I don't know. They were all somebody's mothers and sons and brothers, weren't they?
A couple of fascinating cultural icons, I suppose. One is a book which is out recently, and that is called George, Nicholas and Wilhelm, Three Royal Cousins and the Road to World War One, by Miranda Carter. One of the reviews says, in the years before the First World War, the great European powers were ruled by three first cousins, King George V, Kaiser Wilhelm II of Germany and Tsar Nicholas II of Russia. Together they presided over the last years of dynastic Europe, as you were saying, and the outbreak of the most destructive war the world had ever seen, a war that set 20th century Europe on course to be the most violent continent in the history of the world. And that's absolutely right, isn't it? Because that really led to the Second World War.
It did. The First World War led to the Second World War, and as I said earlier, if the current conflict in the Middle East turns into the Third World War, that had its roots in the First World War as well, and particularly in the peace at the end of the First World War, where the British and the French used the fact that they'd won the war in order to carve up the Middle East between them, cheating the local peoples of any right to self-determination, which they're still fighting for today.
Though brilliant and often darkly comic portraits of these men and their lives, their foibles and obsessions, Miranda Carter delivers a tragicomic story of Europe's early 20th century aristocracy. a solipsistic world. What does that mean?
Self-centered.
Self-centered world. Preposterously out of kilter with its times. Well, I wonder if there's echoes there for today, you know, with an elite now that's out of touch with most of the rest of the world. Anyway, the book again is George, Nicholas and Wilhelm. Three Royal Cousins and the Road to World War One. It's published by Vintage and the author is Miranda Carter. The other thing I'd point people towards, if they haven't seen it, and it'd be nice if they put it on the television this year, we'll see if they do, is Richard Attenborough's probably greatest film, the epic Oh What a Lovely War, which is a translation into film form of Charles Chilton's famous play based on the songs that were sung in the trenches by the soldiers, British soldiers, of the First World War, Martin.
Yes, and I think in actual fact, to try and simplify an event like the First World War into it was a good war and we're glad it took place. I mean, frankly, there is a serious question mark on whether one should celebrate the outbreak of a war anyway. Armistice Day is celebrating the end of the war in 1918. VE Day and VJ Day were celebrating the end of the war. When the anniversary of the start of a war is time for serious reflection. And if we treat it in that way, it might help us to get through the kind of conflicts that we're going to go through in 2014. For example, the Syrian peace conference in Geneva, to which Saudi Arabia has been invited, even though they're supplying the rebels with weaponry to blow things up. And Iran has not been invited, even though their ally Assad is a key player. So maybe we will learn something from the First World War, but the only lesson of history, as somebody once said, is that nobody learns the lessons of history.
Well, back to Seamus Milne's article about World War One, and he points out there's been a bit of a spat between Tony Robinson, who played Baldric in Blackadder, mm-hmm. Their portrayal of the First World War, and Gove. Gove and his fellow war apologists worry that satirical shows such as Blackadder have sapped patriotism by portraying World War One as a series of catastrophic mistakes perpetrated by an out-of-touch elite. There goes for today. The incompetence and cynicism of generals and politicians certainly had horrific results, but it was the nature of the war itself that was most depraved. Fortunately, the revisionists lost the argument among the public long ago, just as Gove has lost his battle to impose a tub-thumping imperial agenda on the school history curriculum. They will keep trying, though, because history wars are about the future as much as about the past. So long as imperial conflict is discredited, future foreign military interventions and occupations will be difficult to sell, Martin. I mean, this is, I suppose, the nub of this, is that actually what they're saying is imperialism is good.
Yes, they are. And that's because we're in a new imperialist age, where we're invading countries on the other side of the world, Afghanistan and Iraq, even though in actual fact it looks like most of the terrorism is being run by Al-Qaeda groups, infiltrated by our intelligence services and set up in the 1980s by them. We are actually in far worse shape than we were in 1914. The possibility, and if you were living in certain parts of the world, and I'm not particularly talking about Bristol here, you know that we're in worse shape than we were in 1914. It's complacent, self-referential, smug, pointless stuff that Gove is coming out with, but he won't succeed because in actual fact the historical record is drenched in blood, and if we're going to examine that historical record as the government seems to want us to do, then we will examine it and they won't like what we find.
Well, Seamus Milne finishes up. For the rest of us, this year's anniversary should be a reminder that empire in all its forms, militarism and national chauvinism, led to bloodshed and disaster. It also contains a warning about the threat from the rise and fall of great powers. China is no imperial Germany, but the US, allied with Japan, is a declining global power in a region in which it is tightening its military grip. It's not 1914, but the dangers are clear.
Yes, that's very obvious. People have often made the case that China is like a new Germany, because Germany, of course, was a rising power, didn't feel it was getting its just desserts, and therefore took the risk of war, supposedly, in order to try and better its prospects as a nation. But, of course, in many of the things that happened were simply accidental, and that people couldn't really control the process of war once it had started, which is why you don't go invading countries like Iraq, because the unforeseen consequences, the unknown unknowns, as Donald Rumsfeld calls them, are dominant in warfare. Always things that will happen which you never expected. Anything that can go wrong in a military operation will go wrong. Violence is inherently unstable.
Okay, final reminder. The book, George, Nicholas and Wilhelm, Three Royal Cousins and the Road to World War One by Miranda Carter, and the film, Oh, What a Lovely War, by Richard Attenborough.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
On to this week's speech by George Osborne now, Martin. He's really setting out his stall. This is promoting the Conservative policy. He's not speaking as a cabinet member, a coalition member here. A Conservative Party pitch, really, for the next general election.
Well, yes. I mean, are we going to hear it? Or do you want me to comment on it before? I mean, I've read about it, but I thought we were going to have clips on it, Tony.
Yeah, well, we are. But am I right in thinking that really this is the election campaign opening up here?
Yes, and also it's a campaign between Osborne, Cameron and Johnson about who's going to lead the Conservative Party. So, there's, you know, you've got to read between the lines here.
Who is the constituency he's speaking to?
The constituency we'll be speaking there to is the Tory activists and B, the Tory funders. Who provide the money. And the three of them are jostling for who is the biggest beast in that particular...
Well, here's a clip from his speech that he made on Monday, which is really setting out this kind of Osbornomics philosophy.
You hear some of my political opponents talking as if the hard part of the job is done and we can go back to the old habits. But beware the opposition politicians who come along this year and promise you easy answers, no more sacrifices... Just more spending on this and more spending on that, all paid for by more borrowing. It was these same promises from these same politicians that brought economic ruin and reckless debt to our country, and they would do so all over again. For the truth is, there are still plenty of risks out there. Our biggest trading partner, the Eurozone, is still weak. And there are fears about slowing growth in emerging economies further afield. Here at home, the banking system is still not working as we need it to do, so we're still fixing it. And we've got to do even more to encourage the exports and the investment and the saving our economy needs for a responsible recovery. Above all, we've still got a huge amount to do to reduce the deficit and to get our debts falling. And it's worth remembering, as the festive season comes to an end, that our own independent Office for Budget Responsibility is predicting a slowing of quarterly GDP growth this year. So it is far too soon to say, job done. It's not even half done. That's why 2014 is the year of hard truths, the year when Britain faces a choice. Do we say the worst is over? We go to our bad habits of borrowing and spending and living beyond our means and let the next generation pay the bill? Or do we say to ourselves, yes, because of our plan, things are getting better, but there is still a long way to go and there are big underlying problems we have to fix in our economy. More repairs, more cuts, more difficult decisions. That's the choice in 2014, to go on working through a plan that is delivering for Britain, putting us back in control of our destiny with the security and peace of mind that brings, or squander what we've achieved and go back to economic ruin. And ultimately, it's your choice, a choice for the British people.
Well, that's an incredibly disingenuous presentation of the situation. When he talks about we've got to stay the course, and he said at one stage, more repairs to our economy, more cuts. So at first they were saying, we're going to have to cut because we don't want to cut, but we're going to have to cut in order to balance the books. The point being made by Keynesian style economists like myself is that you don't balance the books by doing that, because you actually choke off growth, which means that your tax receipts go down, which means that investment goes down, spending goes down, and you actually take less money coming in. So what's actually happened is the deficit year on year has been reduced slightly, but the national debt continues to explode, and it will continue to explode as long as this crisis continues. So there's no hope whatsoever of reducing the national debt by cuts or not by cuts. What he's probably got, he talked about fixing the banking system. The banking system hasn't been fixed at all. All that's happened is we've bailed them out and they've gone and done exactly...
Well, we had
thing.
A commission, Andrew Tyree's commission,
yes,
saying that they're going to split off high street banking from the casino banking, and that Osborne has said it's going to take a few years, but eventually it will happen.
Yes, but they should have done that straight away. Once you've bailed out the banking system, you should take control of it and run it as a public utility. They didn't do that, and of course the change of government meant that it was definitely not on the cards. Now we're still a smaller economy today than we were before the crash. We're still a smaller economy today, even if there is some supposedly measured growth in the economy. But the real problem is quantitative easing. He mentioned the banking system there, and he mentioned debt. The real problem with debt is not the government's debt, it's personal debt. People are going into debt to get educated, to house themselves, and just to keep their spending on essentials. That is the real problem. And the fundamental problem with the banking system is that it's bust, and it always has been bust, and it can only keep going as long as quantitative easing carries on. So we have the temper, what do they call it, the taper tantrum at the beginning of last year, where it was suggested in the US that they might start to raise interest rates and stop quantitative easing, and immediately the market had a fit. Now, of course, they've said that they're going to keep spending, they're going to keep their foot on the QE pedal whatever happens, and the market is going to new highs every day. The Twitter sale of their shares was absolutely absurd. It's worth billions of pounds, apparently, this company, even though it hasn't shown a penny of profit. This looks exactly like the dot-com bubble of 2000, and that's the real problem, and the government has done nothing about that at all. And actually, the wealthy classes, as I made the point in the first hour, have made out like bandits in all of this. What should have been doing is the whole system should have been re-regulated and pointed in the right direction.
Well, you mentioning people making out as bandits, although we're going to be going on further to listen to a bit more of George Osborne's Chancellor's speech, Tony Blair's fortune has been boosted by £13 million by a bumper year last year, we hear in the Independent. Tony Blair has more than £13 million deposited in the bank following his most commercially successful year since quitting Downing Street. The latest accounts for a network of companies used to run his growing business empire show Mr. Blair's business interests around the world are booming. Profits at one company alone, which he owns, totaled £2 million, while shareholder funds on two businesses totaled £7 million. The accounts for the 12 months, April 2013, which were lodged at Companies House, give the best indication yet of Mr. Blair's earning power. His wealth, including a London townhouse, a country estate and several other properties, is estimated now around about £70 million.
Yes, and we could argue that in actual fact his decision to go to war in Iraq was illegal. I would argue that. So he is another one of those that will have to go to prison along with the people that run Barclays Bank, the people that run JP Morgan, and the people that run Goldman Sachs. People have got to understand that the real problem is that the elite is criminalised. And when they say they're wealthy and they've earned their wealth, they have not. Mr. Blair didn't invent a better widget, nor did George Osborne when he got his money from his father. Basically, the wealthy classes have been bailed out by QE. What QE does, and most people, they don't really want to talk about this, but what QE does is it forces up asset prices artificially, which means that everybody who owns assets, the minority of the population that owns assets, and the more assets you've got, the more this will be in your favour. Those assets have gone up in value, whether stocks or property or whatever. And we're now seeing a property bubble beginning to develop in Britain, which is definitely at the lower end for the benefit of people like the estate agent who was helped under Help to Buy, that Cameron was talking to last week. And at the top end, with the Duke of Westminster, they just double their money every year in a property.
Well, is it fair to say with someone like Tony Blair that whilst he's Prime Minister, someone comes and twists his arm gently, maybe wines and dines him and says, well, look, listen, Tony, if you sort this out for us, we're going to make sure you're raking it in your retirement after you leave Parliament. Gordon Brown has not got £70 million bonus, has he? He's got £70 million in the bank now. Tony Blair has, though.
No, he hasn't. But of course, they've all got to take responsibility for that Iraq decision.
People
of Fallujah are taking responsibility for that Iraq decision. They should be taking responsibility.
Was Blair buyable then? I mean, you see, this is what it starts to look like.
But what Blair is selling is his influence. He will have a word in, you know, he works very closely, for example, with the Gulf dictatorships, with the Saudis and the Qataris, the people who are supplying the rebels.
Well, point is, surely, what he's got here is he's cashing in now a promise that was made by the financial elite to him while he was Prime Minister. They've stroked him while he's Prime Minister, and as he's been a good boy, he's now super wealthy.
Yes, it's as blatant as that. Did you know that 75% of British MPs are millionaires? 75%. And this is supposed to be a representative parliament representing the people. Now, that doesn't mean that all the millionaires are bad, because in actual fact, the parliament doesn't decide much anyway. What decides things is Goldman Sachs, is the military-industrial complex, is the Pentagon, and the politicians are simply the front men. And if they do their job properly, they end up like Tony Blair with £13 million in the bank this year. And if they don't do their job properly, they end up dead like Martin Luther King.
So anyway, one of those millionaires is the Chancellor George Osborne. So let's go back to his speech on Monday, earlier on this week. This time he's announcing his £12 billion of extra cuts to the welfare budget.
In 2014, we're bringing in more changes. The long-term unemployed are no longer going to get something for nothing. They're going to have to put something back into their community, including compulsory work with our Help to Work. And this year, for the first time, we will set a cap on the overall welfare budget so it can be properly controlled. Now, state pensions won't be included in that cap. As the Prime Minister was saying this weekend, we are committed to giving everyone who's worked hard and saved hard through their lives the generous state pension they deserve. And the country can only afford to do that because of the difficult decisions we've taken, increasing the pension age as the population lives longer. That saves many billions of pounds, and we need to save billions more from the rest of the welfare budget. And when you think about the competition this factory faces from around the globe and the kind of world your children are going to grow up in, wouldn't it make more sense that your government was spending your money on things like schools and science and a better NHS than more welfare? So here's another hard truth. Welfare cannot be protected from further substantial cuts. I can tell you today that on the Treasury's current forecasts, £12 billion of further welfare cuts are needed in the first 2 years of the next Parliament. That's how to reduce the deficit without even faster cuts to government departments or big tax rises on people. So when you see politicians on the telly who say that welfare can't be cut anymore, or even worse, promising that they'll reverse the changes we've already made and increase, say, housing benefit, ask yourself this. What public services would they cut instead? What taxes would they put up instead? Or would they borrow and spend more and risk our country's economic stability again? That is what I mean when I say that Britain has got a choice. And the truth is, there are no easy options here. And if we are to fix our country's problems and not leave debts to our children to pay off, then cutting the welfare bill further is the kind of decision we need to make.
Well, I mean, he's basically setting out a very clear agenda for the Tory party and for himself as a potential future Prime Minister, I would suggest there. But of course, from an economic point of view, this is gobbledygook. What you have in a welfare system is not an optional add-on in a capitalist economy. It's not something that you have just because you feel generous and that you can get rid of if you don't want it. What a welfare system does is it creates what are called fiscal stabilisers. So, for example, if there is another downturn in the economy, and he's just pointing out there that the Eurozone may go down, America may collapse, there may be a collapse in China. Even a country like Greece defaulting could bring down the banking system. Now, in that situation, your economy could fall through the floor. But what prevents it from falling through the floor is the welfare system, which cushions the economy. It cushions the individuals concerned from severe economic distress, but it also cushions the economy from crashing. Now, taking money off poor people who spend all of their money in the shops is stupid, because all that does is undermine aggregate demand in the economy. Wealthy people actually can't spend all the money they have, so what do they do with it? They speculate in speculative markets with it, which in fact increases the instability of the system and leads to potential crashes. So the whole of his presentation there is economic illiteracy of the highest order. I'm quite sure that there are serious US economists who would agree with everything I am saying there. But it's astonishing that somebody like him can get away with that sort of
presentation. But the reason he gets away with analysis,
because it wouldn't pass. I used to teach A-level economics. That's not even C. Grade. Okay. It's not even C.
The reason he gets away with it, as you put it, Martin, is that this is exactly what a lot of the Conservative Party's city backers want to hear.
That's exactly what they want to hear, and that's who his real audience is. That's what they want to hear. Now, I don't think you can cut £12 billion from the welfare. The welfare budget, don't forget, depends upon how many unemployed you've got. How many unemployed people you've got depends on how many people are claiming. And if unemployment goes up, then the welfare budget goes up willy-nilly. There's nothing you can do about that. And in actual fact, that's a good thing. In Iceland, they've got their massive growth in their economy, and they're roaring back, and they massively increased unemployment benefits. And we should move, in actual fact, towards a society where people are guaranteed an income, and then they can choose to work. And because you can't do that, we can do that. Capitalism has reached an impasse where the wealth of the society is being concentrated in the hands of a tiny minority and everybody else is being pushed to the wall. We've got to completely reverse that with a judo throw and say, no, people come first, and then the economy's got to fit around that. And if that means raising taxes on the wealthy, then that's what we will have to do. And if they say we're going to leave the country, they say you can leave, but your money's not. And don't say we can't track it down in this day and age. Computers make everything possible. Ask Edward Snowden.
Well, let's have a listen now to the conclusion of George Osborne, the Chancellor of the Exchequer's speech on Monday, setting out his and the Conservative Party's economic policy right into the next government, should they be re-elected.
Our long-term plan with five key points: cutting the deficit, reducing taxes for hard-working people, creating more jobs by backing business, capping immigration and welfare, delivering the best schools and skills. It is a plan that is working. But growing the economy, helping businesses succeed, reducing the deficit, these are not an end in themselves. They are a means to an end. So let me set out clearly what that end is, what our long-term economic plan is really for, what the motivation behind it is. Our plan is about more than rescuing our economy from the brink of collapse. It's about instilling a new belief in Britain so we can all live in a country that is in control of its own destiny in this world. A country where we can have the peace of mind that comes from knowing you can provide for your family. A country that offers security and a better life for the next generation. Peace of mind, security, a better life for our children, controlling our own destiny. Our economic plan is for the long term. And just as there are no shortcuts to the work that you do here, there's no shortcut to that economic security for Britain. Thanks to the hard work of the British people, our economy is on the mend and our country is doing better. But what was hard won can be easily lost. So we have this choice in 2014. We can give up, go back to square one, risk everything, or we can confront the hard truth that more difficult decisions are needed and work through the plan that is turning Britain around. I say, let's finish the job. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, I mean, this is basically the same old tired sadomonetarist narrative. Sadomonetarism stems from the idea that if it ain't hurting, it ain't working. So we've got to sacrifice. Of course, not George Osborne's not got to sacrifice. Tony Blair's got to sacrifice. The wealthy classes don't have to sacrifice. The poor people have to sacrifice. And if they sacrifice, then eventually the economy will get better. Now, in actual fact, that's just wrong. Sacrifice, in fact, is just self-harm. It doesn't get you anywhere. What you've got to do is give people real security, whether they are in work or not, and then build from there towards a better society for all. And all the stuff about the end, belief in Britain and all the rest of it, hogwash. Now, if, as I suspect, we hit the brick wall in 2014 and Osborne's head goes through the windscreen, that will be the end of his long-term plan. And no, I don't see there's any point in a situation like this making any plan for what you're going to spend on welfare in a year's time, let alone 5 years' time, because in actual fact, you don't know what's going to happen next week. And that is going to be their undoing. They're basically complacent. They're cruising for a bruising. But that we are the people at the bottom are the people who are basically hurting here. And ultimately, of course, you don't save money by cutting off their lifeline. Those people will make you pay in the end. For example, in Northern Ireland for many, many years, the Catholic community was locked out of high-paid work. And basically,
For centuries, actually.
But of course, what happened in the end is the government spent far more money on Northern Ireland than it would have spent on anywhere else because they made enough trouble to make sure that the government couldn't ignore them. And ultimately, if you push people, that's what will happen. And they won't save a penny by any of this, not a penny. You cut somebody off benefit, what do? They go and steal. Then you have to lock them up. Then they come out again. Now, you can kill them, but then their family get angry, like the Duggan family, and there's guns starting to come into our inner cities, just like in the United States of America. We could modernise to be like the United States of America, in control of our destiny. And the consequences of that in a country the size of Britain are going to be a bit different than in America. In the US, the wealthy can live on the other side of the town, like Los Angeles, and it's 25 miles to the poor neighbourhoods. In Britain, the poor neighbourhoods and the rich neighbourhoods are cheek by jowl. And if things go down the drain, we're all going together. So they better remember that.
Well, one example this week of some of the way that the poorest are being hit is the buy-to-let property supremo, who is now shutting his door on housing benefit tenants. And this is in The Guardian last Saturday. One of Britain's best-known landlords has issued eviction notices to every tenant who's on welfare and told letting agents that he will not accept any more applicants who need housing benefit. Well, who is this? Fergus Wilson. He shot to prominence in 2006 when it was revealed he and his family had built up Britain's biggest ever buy-to-let empire, sometimes snapping up one property every day in the early part of the decade, the noughties.
Yes, and the other thing is he said that we much prefer to have the East Europeans because they're all working and they will pay the rent. So British people on benefits are not going to be able to rent in the private sector at all, and I've recently had experience about this. This is a real problem. There's no social housing for poor people, and there's no private housing for them either. So where are they going to go? Now, the government said they were going to cut the housing benefit bill, and they presume that the landlords would just cut their rents. But, of course, the landlords aren't prepared to cut their rents. So what's going to happen is that the vulnerable all over the country, and don't forget housing benefit is mostly paid to people who are working in Tesco's, working in Morrison's, working in McDonald's, those people are going to lose their housing. Now, I wouldn't predict riots out of this as an immediate response. In the 80s, I think people were more belligerent. They were more prepared to take to the streets than they are now. But ultimately, the social collapse, which will come as a result of this, is going to hit everybody in the country, whoever they are.
What Mr. Wilson said is rents have gone north and benefit levels south. He said, the gap is such that I've taken the decision to withdraw from taking tenants on housing benefit. From what I can gather, just about all other landlords are doing the same. Our situation is that not one of our working tenants is in arrears. All those in arrears are on housing benefit now. Partly this may be due to the fact that the housing benefit is actually paying what it thinks should be a rent, but actually landlords are charging a higher rent than what the housing benefit people will pay.
So the logical conclusion to that is to have rent controls like they do in Germany. But the other point, of course, is if you don't provide housing for low-income people, they won't be housed. And that happened in the 19th century, and everybody lived in slums. And that's where we're going back to. But, of course, in a small country like Britain, you won't be able to escape from the consequences of pushing the very people at the very bottom of the society to the wall. There will be consequences. And the whole attitude of the people running the country at the moment is to line the pockets of the wealthier sections of society. We saw the Help to Buy scheme being pushed this week by Cameron, talking to somebody who's already quite wealthy, being given extra help by the state to buy their own home. Meanwhile, other people are being thrown out on the streets willy-nilly. Now, Cameron is also basically changing direction. If you remember what they were saying when they first got elected, is we don't want to cut, and we've had Jeff Gollop, who's the leader of the Conservatives, on Bristol City Council saying, I didn't go into politics to cut things, and that's the kind of things that Cameron was coming out with before he was elected. Now they're showing their true colours. They want to punish the poor. It's not even about saving money, because there's no evidence that any of this is going to save any money. You cut benefits to the poorest, and you're actually undermining aggregate demand in the economy. And you will find that you haven't got any customers, ultimately.
Well, you mentioned Gordon Brown earlier on. He's also come out saying, stop hurting the jobless, elderly and the disabled, it says in the Daily Mail. Gordon Brown returns from political exile to attack the Tories. He today attacked the Tories. This is the 8th of January. Accused the Tories of targeting the jobless, the elderly and the disabled for no reason in a return to frontline politics. The former Labour Prime Minister and Chancellor accused Conservative George Osborne of presiding over a lost 3 years without economic growth. In a rare public appearance at the launch of a by-election campaign, Mr Brown also warned Scottish independence would result in damaging dog-eats-dog competition between countries to attract jobs and business. Well, isn't that already happening?
Well, it is. I mean, let's leave the Scottish issue aside for the minute. I think Gordon Brown is absolutely right there. You cannot This attack on the poor is A, ideological, and B, to distract attention from where the money has actually gone. The money has gone into the pockets of the bankers. This cannot be stressed loud enough. The reason why we have a deficit is because we bailed out the banks. That's why we've got a deficit. It's not because there's too many people on housing benefit. And the reason the housing benefit bill is going up is because we haven't built enough social housing, which allows the Tory buy-to-let minority in the society to make money out of housing benefit. All the housing benefit actually goes to their own people. You can't see the contradiction. They've cut housing benefit so that the buy-to-let landlords have now decided we're not going to have people on benefit at all. So where are the people on benefit supposed to live? Oh, they're all supposed to get a job. Hang on, we haven't got a job. There's 2.5 million people unemployed even now, and the economy's still smaller than it was in 2008.
Well, it seems like quite a lot of people, maybe we're talking about 2.5 million or so, are just simply going to have to find something out of nothing, somewhere to put a roof over their head. Sounds pretty frightening. I mean, one of the things Gordon Brown says in this speech up in Scotland was that in the last 100 years we created in Scotland and across the United Kingdom a pooling and sharing of resources where everyone, irrespective of their nationality, has an equal right to healthcare, an equal right to unemployment benefit, and an equal right to pensions and all the benefits of a welfare state. If we decide that we want to give that up, people will have to be told.
Well, Gordon, George Osborne is telling us, and basically that was a speech for the bankers. And of course, if people are stupid enough to buy into that, they will get what they deserve. But frankly, what they're trying to do is bribe a certain section of the electorate with public money. Look at what happened with Royal Mail, 70% undervalued. That means that the supporters of the government are being given taxpayer money, and those who don't support the government are being punished. And that is just a political allocation of resources.
It's got nothing to do with
the free market at all.
If you look at energy companies, for example, the big energy companies now, you or I, if we've got £10,000, we could invest that in one of those energy companies. That will return us dividends, which will mean that we don't actually effectively have to pay any energy bills at all. We don't pay our gas bill, we don't pay our electricity bill, because we're getting a dividend from the company. And then in 10 years' time, when we decide to cash in our chips, then that money has gone up in value. So in a way, the rich, if they invest their 10 grand in an energy company, they don't have to pay anything for energy, whereas the poor are picking up almost the entire bill.
Quite so, and of course many of the rich have got a lot more than 10 grand to invest, so they're actually talking about larger amounts of money than that. This system, as a system, is becoming unsustainable. A more important intervention by Gordon Brown was his article in the New York Times before Christmas, where he said that there is going to be another crash. I've been saying that on this programme for years now, Tony. Now, a former Chancellor of the Exchequer, people can say what they like about Gordon Brown. He made a lot of mistakes, including not regulating the City of London, but he's not a stupid guy. When he says there's going to be a crash, I say there's going to be a crash, there is going to be a crash. And so all of this stuff that Osborne is talking is piffle. Because once the crash happens, all of these plans are going to go out the bloody window.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, sorry about the swearing there, but we're moving on now to discuss the National Security Agency. EU's report is revealing a massive scope of the secret NSA surveillance. European Parliament's wrapped up its inquiry into mass surveillance, says Deutsche Welle. In a draft report, the politicians are being hard on all sides, the US government, the NSA, but also on hesitant EU governments and companies. It was the hardly a surprise that only a few seats were filled in room JAN2Q2 at the European Parliament in Brussels, but Claude Moraes, British MEP from the Group of Socialists and Social Democrats, woke the European Union from its winter slumber with a bang. This is a report condemning the mass surveillance going on by GCHQ and the National Security Agency. Martin, I'm going to go back to a book which was written about World War II now, though, by Edwin Black. His book is called IBM and the Holocaust, and here's an extract of an interview by Guerrilla News Network with Edwin Black, the author of the book IBM and the Holocaust.
When I say the information age, I specifically mean the individualization of statistics. This leap across the labyrinth of human understanding occurred when the Hitler regime wanted not only to control its population, but to persecute its individual citizens. IBM knocked on their door. They said, you have a problem, we have a solution. IBM is the solutions company. What I discovered was that there was no solution that the Solutions Company was unwilling to formulate for the Third Reich. IBM was, of course, aware what the technology was being used for, because they had to ask not only what information was to go into a punch card application, but what information the Nazis wanted to bring out of it. By cross-tabulating 24,000 cards per hour, the Reich could quickly identify exactly how many Jews of Polish extraction were in Berlin. All of the Nazi atrocities were vastly headlined in the newspapers of the day, and so Thomas Watson was aware that Adolf Hitler was persecuting the Jews, stealing their assets, and getting them ready for the worst forms of physical destruction, even extermination. And Watson had promulgated the belief that people should disregard this, that this was just politics, and his idea was that it was never about the Nazism, the National Socialism. It was only about the money. And what he told people is, ignore the morality, go for the money. It was the almighty dollar. There is an almighty, and his name ain't dollar. They controlled their Nazi-occupied subsidiaries through Switzerland, and everything ultimately funneled down to an office in New York. It was globalization before you knew the word existed. It was globalization before the word appeared in the English language. IBM danced on the head of a pin to stay within the law. They were, in fact, engaged in the legal participation in genocide. Anyone in the world can call IBM and ask them to open their Polish archives, open their French archives, open their Dutch and Brazilian archives. They won't do it, and they won't tell you why. When people discern atrocities, they see the redness of the blood. They see the blackness of the tragedy. What they need to understand is behind that is the green of money and finance. And we need to draw a line, a moral line.
Edwin Black there, speaking on the Guerrilla News Network. Time to wrap up now. The obvious sign is that watch out, because this is exactly what the Nazis did, these mass data trawls. .org.uk, and we'll be back next week. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, it's emerged a woman who killed herself, blaming the spare room subsidy, needn't have paid it. Stephanie Bottrell from Solihull died last May. The 53-year-old was wrongly identified as being liable for what Labour calls the bedroom tax. Our political correspondent Sophie Rich says it's down to a loophole in government calculations.
An error by the Department for Work and Pensions that's created this loophole, which means that if you have been living in your house for at least since 1996, then you don't have to pay that, because they simply didn't update the housing benefit regulation going back that far.
The Metropolitan Police Commission has apologised to Andrew Mitchell, who was forced to resign from the Cabinet over the Plebgate affair. One of his officers, PC Keith Wallace, has admitted in court he lied when he claimed he saw what happened at the gates of Downing Street. Three people found guilty of abusing 8 elderly dementia patients at a Lancaster nursing home have been jailed for 17 months between them. A fourth has been given a community order. The victims, who were in their 70s and 80s, were bullied and had beanbags thrown at their heads for so-called entertainment. Michael Rowlandson's father was one of them.
The investigation and court case have been extremely distressing for us all, and we do not take any pleasure in the outcome. There are lessons to be learned from this case, and we are contributing to the ongoing learning review, which we hope will provide meaningful recommendations and result in changes to the law.
Two 48-hour strikes have been announced on the London Underground. Members of the RMT union will walk out on February the 4th and the 11th in a row over ticket office closures. In football, Leicester can extend their lead at the top of the...